session number 22676, reel 4.
Major Hutton, reel 4.
Yes, and the Sultan was badly trying to create a period of stability, which really was my time there was creating this period of stability. I was actually at the headquarters because it was a sort of staff job. As is well known, once one's been to the staff college, one has to alternate one's time at regimental duty with serving one's regiment to a 2 or 3 year job on the staff. And this actually was a staff job, and I was fortunate to get rid of a period as a staff job as DAA and QMG, which is, I was the chief administrative staff officer at the headquarters of the Sultan's Armed Forces. It was very unlike the sort of normal staff job, because it's very much a hands-on job of administration. Working in closely with the Defence Department, who were responsible for ordering military supplies from wherever they liked within a defined budget. The regiments were then the Northern Frontier Regiment and the Muscat Regiment, with a small unit called the Oman Gendarmerie, which was also a military unit, which were based in, well, rather like we were in Malaya, in company detachments up country. There were no troops on the coast, because it wasn't on the coast where there had been an internal security problem. The internal security problem was entirely up country, at places like Iski, Nizwa, Ibri, Rostock, and others. And as a headquarters officer, it was one's job to be thoroughly acquainted with the conditions up country, and one visited them frequently, often in the cool of the day. There was a small Royal Air Force detachment called the Sultan of Oman's Air Force, with 4 or 5 piston provost aircraft, which could drop small 500-pound bombs, was equipped with machine guns. And that was our strike force, and as transport, we had 4 or 5 Beavers, which would take 4 passengers or the pilot and stores, that's how we got about the country in the little Beaver aircraft, and there were landing strips at each location. And when one visited a detachment at early in the morning in the cool of the day, and then was entertained for breakfast, and did one's job, and then was flown back. One of the detachments was up on the Jebel, 5,000 foot up at a place called Sake, where there was a fort and an airstrip, and it was wonderful up there because it was cool. One was envious of people who were stationed up there, and that up at Sake was where the final action of the Jebel War had taken place, when the SAS finally overwhelmed the rebel troops, who were now friendly and living up there, still living up there, and one would meet them. I don't know what else to very much to say of one's time up there, because time in SAF, because I actually was there during a very quiet period. It was a period of stability. The army was, as I said, was virtually in control of the country. Although, having said that, there were areas where the Sultan had agreed with the tribal sheikhs that the army would not enter. They said that they would make sure the area was kept quiet as long as the army didn't enter it. And so the Sultan didn't have complete control over the country, certainly as he has now. But having survived that period of stability, unfortunately was brewing up was what is later known as the Dhofar War. Having secured the northern part of the country, and the main Jebel, something rotten was going on down in Dhofar, which started just after I left. So I had no experience of that, although one knows the history of it. Another interesting point there was that it was the naval vessel. There was one naval vessel in the Sultan's Armed Forces, manned by a captain by a retired group captain called Jasper Coates, who's a well-known, almost historical character, Jasper. He had, when he was in the Air Force, he had flown Sunderlands in the Persian Gulf, and he'd actually landed a Sunderland, the flying boat, in or just outside Muscat Harbour. So he knew the area, knew the coastline well, and that, so he had the job of commanding this naval vessel, which was called the Nasr al-Bahr, the commander, which in translation to Arabic is commander of the sea. So the boom, as it's, that was the type of vessel it was, it looks like a dhow, the technical name is a boom, patrolled the coast. And when she needed fitting or repairs, she was taken down to a fascinating ancient place called Sur, spelled S-U-R. All these places have been opened up with roads and goodness knows what to them since then. But a visit to Sur, we're really going back into the times of the Old Testament. Sur is mentioned in the Old Testament. It's an Arab port that's very close to the tip of the Arabian Peninsula. And before you go around the corner to go down the long stretch of coast to eventually reach Aden. And to visit that and see all these old dhows being up out of the water, being prepared, or new dhows being built, was really a most interesting short experience. I can't say I have very much more to say about my time there. One made a lot of good friends there because we were very much thrown together. Social life was very lively, there wasn't much opportunity for sport. We played hockey. There were a lot of Pakistanis about, so that ensured a pretty high standard. And the sailing was marvellous. The sailing off the coast, because there were moderate winds, but to make it interesting. In fact, I learned to sail a dinghy there. After my time there, it was nearly 2 years, I came home towards the end of 1964, having had 1 6-week leave in the middle. Their leaves were very generous. I had leave at the end of 63. But what I must remember that by that time I was 36. I wasn't married. That's really because I hadn't been put in the situation. Admittedly, I had 6 years in England, but nothing came off. But I'd been in situations where it wasn't really easy to find a wife. So when I got home in 64, 65, I thought I'd better get down to that business pretty quickly. So eventually in April next year, 65, I did meet the right girl. There she is. Unfortunately, she's out today. But as soon as I'd popped the question, we were warned for a 9-month unaccompanied tour in England, in Aden, which was very hard on both of us, particularly of her, because she said she had to sit for 9 months and be a good girl while we were engaged. We got married as soon as I got home from Aden. But I've really gone on a bit, because after leaving Muscat at the end of 64, I rejoined my regiment at Tidworth, King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. I was, because I had commanded a rifle company for 2.5 years on the previous tour, I didn't get a rifle company. I got the training company, it wasn't very exciting, really. At the end of, then I became a town sick in command a little later. We went out to Aden then in August 65 for that long 9 months when we were on internal security work in Aden Town most of the time. That was a dreadful job. Nobody can really say there was any redeeming feature about it at all, except that the climate's permanently warm, the sea sports and sailing's good when you've got time to do it. We lived in a horrible camp beyond Kormaxa airfield, the RAF as usual having wonderful accommodation, built pre-war, and the army stuck out in tents where we could find a space. We were very uncomfortable, and we weren't very happy. Our commanding officer did a really great job in keeping the troops from morale fairly high in reasonable shape. It was very hard on married people. The one redeeming feature was that we spent a month up country at a place called Habilane, which is on the edge of the Radfan, and we patrolled the Radfan. Historically, one will remember there was an incident called the Radfan War. Well, that was over by then, but the area still needed patrolling to make sure that nothing tiresome recurred. So that was a better time up patrolling the fairly mountainous area up country Aden, and we quite enjoyed that.
So you were with the 1st Battalion of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry?
Yes, that was my third long tour with them. Yep, once in Malaya, once in Germany and Malaya again, and this time in Tidworth and Aden. And then we came back to Tidworth after Aden, and I promptly got married.
Before we leave Aden, what were your duties and your rank?
I was commanding the training company until the second in command was posted away to another job when I became battalion second in command.
Did you have any attacks on you?
A grenade was thrown into a compound where I happened to be once, but that's it. Yeah, I wasn't actually fired at ever, but the grenade had exploded quite harmlessly.
Where was this compound?
Just at the back of the Marla Strait. To those who know Aden well, as you come in from the area from the crater or from the airfield, you go down this mile-long straight road with flats on either side, flats and shops, and then you come to Steamer Point, which is the part of Aden that is best known because it's got the harbour, it's where the troop ships tied up, where all the shops are that sell duty free goods, and where the headquarters is, and the beaches and the sailing clubs and that sort of thing, best known to the troops. The native part of Aden is called Crater. The town of Crater, which is where the Argyles under Colin Mitchell excelled themselves, one incident, which others can relate, not me. I don't know anything personally about it. I better not say any more.
Was anybody injured in this grenade attack?
No. We were in complete control. There were terrorist groups about, but we were in complete control, and rather like in the early time in Malaya, the terrorists did not take on the army in open fight, nor in fact by ambush. They were far more concerned with terrorizing the civilian population and making life difficult for us politically. And which eventually led to us leaving Aden. And there are many of us who said we should never have left Aden, and it was cold feet on the part of Harold Wilson, as Prime Minister at the time, that we left Aden to the mercy of the communist sort of Maoist guerrillas, who then did dreadful things to the people who'd supported us, of course. We weren't there to know the tale. But we withdrew. I think we pulled out of Aden in 66. I wasn't, or 67. I certainly wasn't there. We left Aden in May 66. after 9 months there.
Did you ever feel apprehensive there?
No. No, and took precautions. If you went into a shop, it was as well to have a friend standing outside or one's driver standing outside, because they might roll a grenade into the shop. One took precautions of that kind. One went about armed, with escorts and so on and so forth. But we went about very freely, taking precautions of that kind.
Was it possible to apprehend the enemy?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that chap was really that sort of terrorist that's keen to be apprehended. He just slips out of the shadows and slips away again.
Did you ever have any other active service after Aden?
After Aden? I don't think I did, no. No, because we then went back to Tidworth spent the rest of that year doing normal training in UK. I was second in command, helping the commanding officer train the battalion. The following March, the battalion was posted to Berlin, March 67. But at the same time, I got, having done a spell of regimental duty, I got another staff appointment, which was actually my best staff job. I was DAG Berlin, which was a high-profile job, because you were in charge of the ceremonial, and ceremonial meant a lot in Berlin. And typical of the army, they put someone in a job who said no experience or something he's going to do. It's the army's thing that he's jolly well got to get down and learn it, get on with it. It's been a philosophy throughout the ages. I think you're put in a job, you've no idea how to do it. But so one had to have the learning curve was pretty sharp upwards. But I actually took the battalion out to Berlin, because my staff job wasn't starting till June. I took the battalion out. The CO wanted some leave too, because he'd just bought a farm near Wincanton, and he wanted to start getting that going for as his future home. And so I took the battalion out, and my wife, who was very recently married, had to do commanding officer's wife, which was quite a new in at the deep end for her. Berlin, of course, was a very good station, comfortable station. Plenty to do there, the battalion occupied barracks right down at the very bottom west-south-west corner of the British sector, right on the wire with the communist East Germany, after just over 2 months there, I went to the brigade headquarters, where I was right in the deep end. With the Berlin Tattoo, which was a very, very major event, coming off that September.
What were relations like with the East Germans and Russians?
We had no contact with them at all. The only contact we had was when we went into the eastern sector of Berlin. We were allowed into East Berlin. In fact, we were encouraged to do so, because, as is well known, Berlin was a quadripartite city, with the four powers, American, British, French and Russian, in equal control of it, but having their own sectors where their troops would be stationed. The Russians, of course, has quickly made during the time of the blockade, quickly turned things the way they wanted them, where there would be a strict dividing line between the Russian sector and the three Western sectors. And impose sort of communist rule and communist system under a puppet East German government in the East Berlin and the rest of East Germany. We were encouraged to go into East Berlin. We had to go in military transport and uniform, which made it quite an expedition. And it wasn't next door either. I mean, it was 10 miles from my house to the checkpoint Charlie, 10-mile drive. So one didn't sort of pop over every afternoon. The the Western powers encouraged Western troops to be seen in East Berlin. They're entirely entitled to be there and to go about freely there. The thing we went to most were the operas, because the two main old Berlin opera houses were in East Berlin, the Staatsoper and the Komische Oper. Important museums, the Pergamon particularly, was in East Berlin. There was also the attraction of cheaper shopping, because the East German mark was worth a lot less than the West mark. And although we were supposed to change for one for one, I can unashamedly say that very few people did. And they got five East marks to one West mark.
How did you manage that?
Oh, you could go into a bank. You weren't supposed to. In fact, as DAG, who was responsible for discipline in the Berlin Infantry Brigade, it's not really right for me to say this, but I've been gone far too long for them to court-martial me now. The two pictures in the dining room were bought with East marks.
What was the attitude of East Berliners?
East Berliners were very glad to see us. They were very glad to see us, because of course they didn't. Everyone's terrified. Everyone's always terrified of Russians. Even we're terrified of the Red Army, because it's unpredictable. So the East Berliners actually were very pleased to see us. Our relations with the Germans were perfectly good. Perfectly good. The West by then was very prosperous. But the East Berliners weren't. My time in Berlin, I was aware that I hadn't great promotional prospects, and as I had a young wife with a small family on the way, it was much easier to be job mobile in civilian life with a small family rather than with children already committed to education and so on and so forth and reliant on the army education allowance. So I decided that I would leave the army after my next job, study for a civilian job, and job hunt, which I did commencing. I started job hunting in the turn of 1970-71. I worked for the Chartered Institute of Secretaries exams, and I qualified as a company secretary. I left the army in April 71, and was lucky enough to get a civilian job just starting on June the 1st, 71, which I then held for 21 years.
Was it difficult to readjust to civilian life?
It's funny, it's suddenly crossing the Great Divide. It's like crossing the River Styx. You're not quite sure what you're going to come across the other side, but you're still the same person, and it's still the same world. Yes, it is different. The army is closely regulated. You can trust people in the army, because if there's something wrong, you are told. In civilian life, they tend to hold it against you, and suddenly your desk cleared and you're out of the job. That didn't happen to me, but that is an experience. And another thing I had no experience with either was handling female staff, because I took over an office of about 14 staff, about most of whom were ladies, and they do act and think differently and need to be handled differently to men, and certainly to soldiers. So I had to learn a bit in the way of staff handling. And then, of course, I had to learn the professional side of the work. But having qualified in the company secretary's exams, I had some idea of what to expect. And I was very keen on finance and accounts. I was a bit of a number cruncher. I'd always been the guy people turned to for advice when they had to be president of audit boards and so on and so forth. So numbers and accounts were my strong suit. And I went into a job where there was quite a lot of that to do, and eventually had to learn computers, and so we went on. And here we are today. I've been retired 10 years now. Retired from that. I retired at 65.
Do women in the army react differently or need different handling from women in civilian life?
In my day, we had no contact with women in the army. The nearest I got, was two doors down the passage in Berlin. The staff captain Q was a member of the WRAC, as it was still known then. I had no experience whatsoever with handling ladies in the armed forces. So officers and NCOs these days have a new experience.